in the passage we just read, one of the most familiar passages, I would argue, in all of Christendom, at least in the West, at least, or in North America. I think Christ is giving us an application of what he began earlier in the chapter. And I know we sometimes pass comment on the chapter divisions, but I think in this case, they did a very good job. Christ is asking us to make judgments or evaluations there in verse 15. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravenous wolves. They're not casual wolves. They're not wolves stopping by for tea. They're not wolves that are just passing through. They are wolves that want to destroy. They want to consume and they want to destroy. But they look like sheep. Now, if there's any animal ever that looks harmless, is it not a sheep? Is it not a lamb? Who's afraid of a lamb? A sheep? No one. Who's afraid of a wolf? Everyone. Or everyone should be, because if you see one wolf, there might be a pack someplace. There might be more. Probably is more. Wolves generally don't hang out by themselves. And even in the passage itself, Christ uses the plural. He says, beware of false prophets, plural, who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. More than one prophet, more than one wolf. Now we miss what I think the import of what Christ is saying, because we get stuck often enough in the very beginning of the chapter. Now, this is a passage that we know something about, is it not? Verses 1 and 2, judge not, that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And then Christ goes on to say, take out the speck. And of course, in your eye, of course, the reason to take out the speck in your eye is so that you will be able to accurately judge. That's the point. That's what he says here in verse 6, do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine. Meaning this, that if you will remove the speck from your eye, now you will be able to evaluate what is a dog and what is a pig. But I think the ultimate evaluation here, the ultimate judgment that he is making here, is, and the point, you must do this. You must be able to evaluate accurately in order to identify the false prophets, in order to identify the ravenous wolves that will tear you apart. Well, that's their goal. If you do not remove the block from your own eye, we will get back to the rest of it later on, and I think there's even more application in what we read this morning. But we're going to see later on that what Christ is saying here is precisely the same, exactly the same as what James says. No different between the two at all. So if you would, turn with me to James chapter 3. James 3. James 3, 1 through 12. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers or masters, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships, although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast, bird, reptile, and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It is unruly, evil, full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter water from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus, no spring yields both salt water and fresh. James is making some bold statements here. He's saying, I know what you believe about God by what you say about other people. I thought all we had to do was, you know, say nice things about God. That's all we have to do. But James is saying what Christ has said before. Remember what Christ said about the Pharisees? They love to make long prayers. The Pharisees loved to say wonderful things about God, but they hated their neighbors. And James is saying the same thing here. Yes. And James is very clear here. I don't really care what you say about God, James says. I'm more concerned about what you say about your neighbor. I'm more concerned with what you say about your brother. That is what's going to tell me what's really in your heart. We think the opposite, do we not? We flit away when people say awful things about our brother. No worries. When the slander goes on, no problem. What does he say about God? This is why, again, where this James, the book of James is so difficult, it sounds so opposite from what we, so many things that we believe, and so many things that we've come to accept in our modern culture. Years ago, British historian Paul Johnson wrote a book called Intellectuals. If you're familiar with it, you know that Paul Johnson painted, and this is from the front of it here, a fascinating portrait of the minds that have shaped the modern world in an intriguing series of case studies. And he starts naming names that are big in our Western culture now, names that are supposed to be listened to. And here's a few of them: Rousseau, the poet Shelley, Karl Marx, Leo Tolstoy, Ernest Hemingway, Bertrand Russell, Jean-Paul Sartre, Lillian Hellman, Norman Mailer, and many others. These were men that became highly skilled at telling everybody else how to live, and women in some cases. And the point of Johnson's book, Intellectuals, a book I frankly highly recommend. What do we have here? It's not working for us. Is that better? The book Intellectuals, and again, I recommend, if you get a chance to read it, it's a good book. What Johnson does in the book is he contrasts two things. Johnson, throughout the whole book, is kind of like an illustration of the book of James, when you get a chance to read it. What Paul Johnson does is he talks about these intellectuals who know how to tell the rest of us how to live and who themselves could not come up to their own standards of what they were telling everybody else to do. That, to me, is just a complete illustration of the entire book of James. And he names these names and he talks about their own personal lives. Men who, in some cases, fathered children. And as soon as the child was born, took it down to the orphanage, donated the child to the orphanage pretty much on the day of its birth. At the same time, professing about how much they loved humanity. We've talked in the past about Karl Marx, a truly wicked man, who was constantly carping on and on about people working for free, and about how people should be paid, and about how capitalism exploited the masses and so forth. And how the workers had to rise up, and had a worker in his own house by the name of Lenchen, a young lady who was a servant, who he never paid her a dime, and who he personally got pregnant and never recognized the child. This was Karl Marx. Mr. Workers of the World Unite. Mr. Let's Stop Exploiting People. Yes, he could preach a good sermon, but he couldn't practice what he preached himself. And James, in his book, is aiming his arrows at all those throughout history who were really great at speaking great words, but who could not support their words by their own actions. One reviewer says this about Paul Johnson's book. And I want you to hear what this reviewer says, because this reviewer has put his finger on the problem. And the problem is that the church has lost its voice of moral authority. The ecclesiastical class, if you will, if that's a good way to say it, lost its moral authority, and into the vacuum has stepped the secularists, whose premise is they first reject God, they reject his word, but they have to do that in order for us to listen to them. It's not enough just to destroy the Bible. You have to destroy the Bible in order to listen to those who would tell us how to live. And the reviewer says this: the violent collapse of the ecclesiastical caste precipitated by the French Revolution has given rise to the secular intellectual armed with their scintillating rhetoric and dazzling display of scholastic aptitudes. And that's so true, is it not? These folks who want to tell us how to live, professing from their ivory towers in our universities, with their scholastic titles, their DDs and their DDSs behind their names. They're there to tell us how to live. These social, cultural elites have become guardians of cultures and devised moral and ideological innovations, thus replacing the ancient regime of the priestly or pastorly caste. Paul Johnson's Intellectuals lays bare the human frailties of these beneficent intellectuals. Intellectuals have traditionally proclaimed themselves to be liberals, torchbearers, fraternity, equality, liberty, since they became the new potent oracles of societies, dictating modes of life and modus operandi of political, social, and cultural systems. We have folks every day telling us how to live who can't live themselves. How many of you know right now? I don't need to see your hands. How many of you know right now of so-called family therapists, highly credentialed counselors, who themselves are presiding over a disastrous family? I know of cases like that. I know one case of a man who is supposed to be a great teacher of how the family is supposed to be, and people come to him and talk to him about their problems, while he himself, his own family, is a complete disaster and a complete wreck. But that doesn't stop him from telling everybody else how to live. You know why we should listen to him? Because he's credentialed. He has a very cool-looking certificate on the wall that tells the rest of us that he knows how to live. And none of us ask, or too few of us ask, how are you doing? How is your counsel working in your life? Are you living by your own counsel? How's it working for you? Oh no, he has the credentials on the wall. That's all we need. And James is telling us, forget about the credentials on the wall. Watch to see what the man does and how he lives. What I'd like to do this morning then, my simple point, is that the tongue has a great capacity for evil. It also has a capacity for good, as we'll see. But James' concern is the capacity for evil, especially when divorced from how we live. You see, my friends, understand me on this, please. Please understand this. If we were really concerned that our actions matched our words, then we would be more careful about our words, would we not? We would care about our words if that made a difference. But when we decide that it doesn't matter how we live, it only matters what we say, then our tongue gets turned loose. And I think what James says, that fire of iniquity, that deadly poison, gets loosed on everyone. Now a word here a brief word. We've already made brief words about this. We'll make another one. Probably won't be the last one. I was asking myself this week as I was studying this, I was thinking this through. What would James think about social media? And see, I think we have a little bit of a problem here. We blame social media. You've probably heard people do that, right? Blame Facebook. Blame blogging. But I don't think the technology itself can be blamed. What happens is the technology has made it possible for what's really inside to come out. And it's ugly in many cases. But see, that's what social media can do, right? Social media, by definition, separates me from my actions. You only see what I'm saying in my social media outlet, right? That's all you see. You do not see my own life. By definition, you don't. What a wonderful thing to be able to say something and not have to be stuck with backing it up by my own life. And James is saying, I don't want to hear what you have to say if you can't live what you're talking about. Francis Schaeffer asked this years ago. He asked, how should we then live? But today's modern intellectual says, what shall we then say? And that's all we have to worry about. Well, let's quickly go through this passage. We'll discuss it briefly. And then I want to go to other passages in the Bible as we wrap up and as we apply this, to talk about what James is saying here. My friends, throughout this book, if we can just get it across that what we say has to match what we do, our speech itself will be so much more easily digested. Our speech itself will be so much more full of grace because we will understand the difficulty of living what we say, and we will be so less quick to slander our neighbor if we can match the two up. My brethren, and there's James using that term of endearment once again. It's so wonderful to see that because James sounds like he has such a difficult message for us. But he once again starts out, my brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment or the greater condemnation. Now this trips us up a little bit. It says, some say masters. It says masters in some cases, or teachers. What do we mean here, masters, teachers? And normally masters we mean, someone who tells something else what to do, like a slave or master-type relationship. But I think what John Calvin here says here helps us. He says this. He says, I take masters not to be those who performed a public duty in the church, but such as took upon them the right of passing judgment upon others. For such reprovers sought to be accounted as masters of morals. And I think he's put his finger right on it there. If you can be the master of morals, you can kind of be the master of everything, can you not? Because if you're the master of morals, you can tell everybody how to live, what's right, what's wrong. And you can be their master kind of like without being the master. Without cracking the external whip, you're cracking the internal whip. This is how you must judge yourself. And this is what James is saying. And I think he's being very loving here, starting out saying, my brethren. And I think he could have easily said, my brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that you shall receive a stricter judgment. But James is putting himself in their class there. He says, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. And Calvin goes on to say, and that he forbade them to be many, it was done for this reason, because many everywhere did trust in themselves. For it is, as it were, an innate disease in mankind to seek reputation by blaming others. I want you to think again, social media, when I read that sentence. I want to read it again. Is this not what happens often enough? And may it not be true of you and I? For it is, as it were, an innate disease in mankind to seek reputation by blaming others. He goes on to say this. And in this prospect, or in this respect, a twofold vice prevails. Though few excel in wisdom, yet all intrude indiscriminately into the office of masters. I was reading this last night, right? And we were talking, and I said to Audrey, John Calvin is attacking Facebook. And Audrey said, "What are you talking about?" And I read that. I'll read it again. In this respect, the twofold vice prevails. Though few excel in wisdom, yet all intrude indiscriminately into the office of masters. And then this is, and then he's got the other side of this coin here, which is very, very concerning. He says, and then few are influenced by a right feeling, for hypocrisy and ambition stimulate them, and not a care for the salvation of their brethren. In other words, we have so many voices here, all proclaiming wisdom. With all these voices of so many proclaiming wisdom, how can you identify what really is wise? And I think that's really going back to what James is saying. Let not many of you be these guardians of morals and the judges of other people. He goes on to say, it is observed that James does not discourage those brotherly admonitions, which the Spirit so often and so much recommends to us, but that immoderate desire to condemn, which proceeds from ambition and pride when anyone exalts himself against his neighbor. My friends, is John Calvin not describing what goes on in social media all the time? Ambition, pride. And it's not really about what's right and wrong. It's about condemning my neighbor because of my own ambition and pride. And James, again, is attacking that. And that's what he says here in verse 2. We all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, but also able to bridle the whole body. Now, I thought it's about what you do. It's not about what you say. But what James is saying here is that what you say is so often awful and terrible and wicked that it affects the rest of your body, affects the rest of your life. And then he's got a couple of examples here. He's got the horse example, and he's got the ship example. Now, interestingly enough, what he's doing here is he's using, shall we say, a physical illustration. He's saying there's two small things here that have great consequence. In the case of ships, you have the wind blowing it about. It's a huge thing, and a very small thing directs it. It's a rudder. And then he talks about the horse. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths, and they obey us, and we turn their whole body with that small bit. And, you know, in both cases, these are things that can hardly be seen. Interestingly enough, that our tongue is rarely seen, actually. But it does all kinds of things to other people. It's barely seen. It's a small member of the body, if you will. But look what it can do. And this is where I say, I don't think James is saying the tongue is always doing bad things. Turning the ship is a good thing. Turning the horse is a good thing as well. But his illustration is by one of contrast. Because look, even so the tongue, verse 5, is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. And then he goes on to say this. Tongue is a fire. It is a world of iniquity. My friends, do you consider this? Do you and I consider this before we open our mouths at difficult times? Oh man, if you had to think about this every time, you'd never talk again, right? Well, you'd still continue to talk. But did you ever think that what I'm about to say could be setting a fire, and that where it's coming from could be a world of iniquity? Do we think about this? I don't, myself, to be honest with you. I'm so busy throwing out my grand pearls of wisdom. World of iniquity? Let's see. So set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, and is set on fire by hell? You mean my tongue is set on fire by hell? What's James talking about? What does he mean here? Well, Calvin again. He says this. When he says it is set on fire by hell, it is the same as though he had said that the outrageousness of the tongue is the flame of the infernal fire. For as heathen poets imagine that the wicked are tormented by the torches of the furies, so it is true that Satan, by the fans of temptation, kindles the fire of all evils in the world. But James means that fire sent by Satan is most easily caught by the tongue. I think that's what he's talking about here. I'll read that again. James means that fire sent by Satan is most easily caught by the tongue, so that it immediately burns. In short, that it is a material fitted for receiving, fostering, and increasing the fire of hell. When I was in the continent of Africa, one of the things I was warned about was, as we traveled in some of these cities, always be careful, because depending on what the situation is, you could be driving straight into a riot. Now, that was intriguing to me. I had a hard time figuring out how, what do you mean, riot? What are you talking about here? And so what happened was, and what I was shown, was that apparently a rumor can get started. And what Charles, who I was with, he said, the way it happens is, if you'll see a whole bunch of people running towards one. This just isn't working. I'm going to have to use this. Can I do that? Thanks. This is just not working for me today. Always appreciate those who work hard. And you just see a whole bunch of people like running towards the same spot. Now, that was odd to me, and perhaps odd to you. I mean, if you and I, if someone said, hey, you know, there's this great outrage happening here, let's run and let's fix it, you'd probably think, well, how am I going to help fix it? And is this really true? And so forth. But apparently, in many of these cases, no one asks. And apparently, a riot is easy to start, because the fire of hell, if you will, is easily spread from tongue to tongue, and before you know it, you have buildings burning and people dying, people killing each other. I believe that's what James is talking about here. I'd like to think that if we have teaching, proper teaching here from James, that we will not be as concerned, shall we say, about what people say when it comes to things of great import, things of great difficulty, things that are hard to believe, that we don't just believe them necessarily, but we're so saturated by the Word of God that we think these things through a little more carefully. Moving on. Every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creatures of the sea, is tamed and has been tamed by man or mankind. Now, this is intriguing, because he says this, and I don't want to spend a whole lot of time here, every kind of beast. He doesn't say every beast. He says every kind of beast, of bird, of reptile, and creatures of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. The idea of taming creatures from the sea is a somewhat difficult one to imagine, but certainly certain sea creatures have been tamed. We think of perhaps dolphins and so forth, and others. Reptiles, maybe not so much. Birds, yeah, kind of beasts and birds, yes. Reptiles, yeah, some reptiles, I suppose, are tamed. Some are not. But here's his point. Right in verse 8, he said, they've been tamed by mankind. In other words, he's saying, you can tame animals. You can tame beasts, for Pete's sake. Even fish or animals in the ocean can be tamed. Reptiles. Normally we think of reptiles as what? Nasty little things that just bite people, right? Come on. reptiles, ugly. I mean, come on. Gila monsters, snakes, alligators. Even they can be tamed, but his point is, I got something in front of you that's worse than them. Think of the worst beast that's ever been tamed. Reading this week, apparently, I didn't know this, but apparently Indians, even in this country, apparently were able to tame panthers. Apparently. Panthers that did roam the forest here in North America at one time, still do in some cases. Apparently they were able to tame even them. Huge cats they could tame. But James says it's something you can't tame. Compare the tongue, this little member, to these huge animals that can be tamed. I got something James says can't tame that. And he even says by tamed by mankind. He says man can tame all these things, but man can't tame the tongue. Can't do it. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. What kind of poison? What's that poison look like? Well, the poison looks like cursing. Next verse. With it we bless our God and Father, and we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. Now let's be sure what we're talking about here. We're actually talking about cursing our neighbor here. We're not talking about evaluating something we see that's obvious. We're not talking about something we see as, hey, you know what, that's not a good decision, I don't think that's going to work out well. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about calling down curses on our neighbor here. What does cursing look like? And in my own study of this, the best I can tell from this, the word slander keeps coming up again and again, which to me makes sense with what Calvin said earlier. Because so often, how do we build ourselves up? We don't build ourselves up at all. We just have to beat down all the competition. And how do you beat down the competition? You do it through slander. We bless God our Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. And then here's his application. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be this way. And I'm not, this is somewhat hard and somewhat difficult to for me to actually interpret here. He says these things ought not to be so. And then he says this, can a fig tree, says it shouldn't be this way. And then later on, it seems like he says it can't be this way. Okay, you see that? He says that they ought not to be so. And then he says it's impossible for it to be. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter water from the same opening? So it can't be. Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus, no spring yields both salt water and fresh. So he's saying, I believe what I said in the beginning. I know what you believe about God. I know where you are with God by what you say about your neighbor. If you are cursing your brother, I know something about you and your relationship to God. I believe he's saying this in clear terms. Now, again, I think his application is going to come next week once again. I think he says something, his application comes. So this is the application of what he said before, the justification by works. Now he's going to talk about what he's saying here next week or in the next verse. Who is wise and understanding among you? Normally, and we won't spend time on this, we'll spend time on this next week. But verse 13, who is wise and understanding among you? Normally we would say, well, whoever is wise and understanding is the one who talks great things and says great words and impresses us with his speech. And James says, none of that. No. I'll tell you who's wise and understanding among you. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. James is saying, we'll talk about it more next week. James is saying, clearly enough, you want to be wise? You want to know if somebody's wise? Do you want to know this? Look at what he does.
And the motivation for what he's doing it as well is what he says at the end of it. My friends, this is just opposite from what we think most of the time, is it not? Let's listen to the words, the silvery, velvety words of the great speakers. There we will find wisdom. James says, no. Watch what they do. Now, I want to talk briefly then about the value of a local assembly. Of course, this is a time when we don't need to go be involved in a local assembly. We can just listen to a sermon sometime, or even attend a virtual church, which is becoming a bigger and bigger thing. But my friends, without a local assembly, how are you going to understand verse 13? How are you going to be able to see the good conduct and the works? And really, honestly, if we could be more close, if we could see each other more closely, then it would divide us more, perhaps, would it not? It might be divisive at first. We can go to a really large church when nobody knows us, we're somewhat anonymous, and we can attend, but you know what? The closer we get to what we actually do, how we actually act, it becomes divisive, if you will. And I actually believe that's a good thing, not a bad thing. Because James is making a division. That's what he's doing. Who is wise? I'm going to separate, James says. I'm going to separate the wise from the unwise. Watch to see what they do. Well, more on that next week. That is a critical verse, and that is something we all must understand. I want to take a quick look here now, very quickly, at five other passages that I believe say exactly what James is saying, very quickly. Let's go back quickly to Matthew chapter 7, where we were earlier today. Matthew 7. We've talked about this before. We won't spend much time on it. I venture to say that in future sermons, this will come up again. Verse 24. Let's start with verse 21. Not everyone who says... See, we see this division between saying and doing. Verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will. You see it? Does that not sound exactly like James? We go on. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name and cast out demons in your name and done many wonders in your name? So we start out with a saying and end up with a doing. But then I will declare to them, I never knew you. You depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. I don't care about what you say. You say you've done some things, but you've the whole time you've been saying good things, but practicing wickedness. I believe this has a very local application to the people that he was talking to. It applies to us as well, but it's very local. Then he goes on and says the exact same thing in verse 24. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house upon the rock. Verse 26, but everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be likened to a foolish man. No different from James. 2 Peter chapter 2. Very quickly. 'Cause it sound like I'm beating this halfway to death. 2 Peter chapter 2. Verse 12. But these, like natural brute beasts made to be caught and destroyed, speak evil of the things they do not understand and will utterly perish in their own corruption. Now, that's a pretty rough look there. They're like natural brute beasts made to be caught and destroyed. Wow. They will receive the wages of unrighteousness as those who count it pleasure to carouse in the daytime. They are spots and blemishes, carousing in their own deceptions. while they feast with you, they fellowship with you, having eyes full of adultery, and that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls. They have a heart trained in covetous practices and are accursed children. Wow. Should be able to recognize them, right? Oh, look, they have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he was rebuked for his iniquity, a dumb donkey speaking with a man's voice. These are wells without water, verse 17, clouds carried about by tempest. This is really bad people. But now watch this. Watch how they talk. Okay, this is who they are. But if you listen to them, you're going to have something really different. For when they speak great swelling words of emptiness, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through lewdness, the ones who have actually escaped from those who live in error. While they promise liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. Can you believe that people that are this bad, like natural brute beasts, wicked, eyes full of adultery, can sound really good? And Peter says, yeah, they can. Moving on, Jude, a few pages over. Jude, verse 14. Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men also, saying, behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment on all, convict all who are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds, which they have committed in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. These are grumblers, complainers, walking according to their own lusts, and they mouth great swelling words, flattering people to gain advantage. Do we understand that there are people in our accepted circles of influence who are mouthing great swelling words to gain advantage over other people? My friends, we have the warnings in the Bible about these things. Proverbs chapter 20. Many places we could go in Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 6. Just so we know that what is in the New Testament is not already said in the Old Testament. Most men will proclaim each his own goodness, but who can find a faithful man? You can find all kinds of virtue out on social media. It's everywhere. The virtuous are speaking. But faithfulness, fidelity to God, to his word, Proverbs says, who can find it? Finally, then, I'll just mention this last one. We won't look at it because we don't really quite have time. But there is a case in Judges chapter 9, verses 26 through 38, where somebody's mouth really got him in trouble. He spoke great swelling words, and he got people to believe him, and in the end, it got him destroyed and the others with him. That's in Judges chapter 9. We won't look at it. Instead, we'll look, and I've had to switch my application today after a conversation this morning. Let's go to Psalms chapter 15. Switch the application here. Psalm 15. As I've said before, one of my worries about social media and social justice warriorism is social justification. And so while we're worried about being justified by our social circle, we then are not worried about being justified by God himself. What does God think of us? What does God think of the way we conduct ourselves? Well, we'll find out. Psalm 15. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? Now, let's back up a little bit. Let's ask the question that might be more on the minds of many, hopefully not us. hopefully not you and I. Lord, who may abide in our little circle? Who may abide in our Facebook group? Who may abide in my little blog series of blogs? He who agrees with me and thinks I am an oracle of wisdom. But we're not talking about my little group here. We're talking about something else. We're talking about the tabernacle of God himself in his holy hill. And look what he has to say about what we do versus what we say. Same thing here as James. First of all, he starts out, he who walks uprightly works righteousness. And he speaks. But he speaks the truth in his heart. He doesn't backbite with his tongue. You see, he's talking here about the tongue, but it's mostly, so far he mentions the tongue twice, or speaking twice. In the first case, it's speaking that something no one can hear. And in the second case, it's saying what he doesn't do with his tongue, not what he does do. He doesn't take up a reproach against his friend. Oh, he does despise a vile person. That's what we saw earlier there with the wolves in sheep clothing. He honors those who fear the Lord. And look at this. He does say something publicly, but it's not how great he is. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. He who is faithful to what he actually says. You see what the psalmist is saying here, what David is saying here? He's saying here, when he says he who swears to his own hurt, he's saying the guy who really does practice what he preaches. There really is a connection between what he says and what he does. Because if there's no connection between what you say and what you do, you can swear all you want. You can make all the oaths you want. You can say, I swear to God, and all that kind of blasphemous stuff that people say. That doesn't matter. I don't have to do what I said. But again, my friends, if we make that connection between what we say and what we do, our speech will be so much more gracious. Where are we at today, my friends? How concerned are we about the holy hill? How concerned are we about being what James is encouraging us to be today? That consistency between what we say and what we do. I'll close by saying this. In the family, one of the most difficult jobs ever, as a pastor or as an uncle or as an aunt or as just a concerned family member or just a concerned friend, I think one of the most difficult conversations in the world, and I've had some of these myself, is to talk to those kids who have grown up in a family where dad and mom said one thing and did another. Oftentimes these families fall apart. Oftentimes also, it didn't stop the mom or oftentimes the dad from being this proclaimer of goodness and righteousness, even while his family was falling apart around him and he was destroying his wife and his family. I've seen it. We've seen it here in this church, have we not, John? Have we not? From the very beginning, we saw it. Try to talk to those kids. Just try it. Try to talk to the kids where dad was destroying everything by his life, but still mouthing platitudes about how to be a good Christian. Try talking to those kids, my friends. It's the hardest conversation you will have. James is trying to get us to stay away from that. He gets the destruction. We don't get it like we should. But James gets the destruction that occurs when what we say does not match what we do. Shall we pray? We are grateful, O Lord, for James. How much easier it would be to disconnect and stand up and say, as many have said before us, hey, there doesn't have to be a connection between what we say and what we do. It doesn't matter. But we see all throughout your word that it does matter. And may it matter to each and every one of us this day, O Lord, we ask. We pray in the name of Christ, our Savior and Lord. Amen.